First of all, I would like to thank the organizer for giving me opportunity to talk about my research. Oh, I guess maybe I'll wait a second. All right, so this is a plan for the next half an hour or so. I divided my talk into two parts. In the first part, I'm gonna give you a general introduction to tensor networks algorithms. And I'll try to be pedagogical, at least at that part, so we'll see many examples. But in the end, I would like to focus on matrix product states, because that's going to be my main tool in the second part of the talk. In that part, I'm going to show you how can you use matrix product state together with infinite cylinders to characterize topological order that's going to emerge from a microscopic 2D lattice Hamiltonian. Okay, but first of all, why do we care about tensor networks, right? So we're gonna simulate quantum many-body systems here. So in particular, if once I'm given a Hamiltonian on a lattice in 1D or 2D, I would like to have a tool that would allow me to calculate a ground state of that Hamiltonian. And if we are not lucky enough, then there's no analytical solution for that. So we are looking for some kind of numerics, right? So the first thing that probably comes to your mind when you think about numerics in that context is exact diagonalization, right? So this is a very good tool, but it's limited to small system sizes. And that's because very basic observation that the Hilbert space of your, the dimension of the Hilbert space of your system grows exponentially with the size of the system. So another way to think about that is to ask a question, okay, so how many coefficients do I need to store on my computer in order to represent a many-body wave function? And the answer is, it's d to power n. Where is that? Okay, d to power n, where d is the local dimension of a Hilbert space and n is the size of the system. So it's not efficient at all. You can take the fastest computer on the planet, right? You can use all symmetries of your problem, but still you are tired after, say, 40 sites, maybe 50 sites, okay? But we don't want 40 or 50 sites. We need more, like 100,000, millions, or even infinite. Okay, so I would like to have a tool that would work in a thermodynamic limit from the beginning, so no extrapolation needed. So one of the solutions is to use tensor network algorithms, and the basic idea is to take that huge, huge wave function that you can't even put on your computer and split it into a carefully chosen network of small tensors. And the small tensors are that small that I can fit into my computer. Okay, so this is all good, but probably to understand that, I need to show you some notation to appreciate those pictures. So every time you see a shape without any legs coming out of it, that's just a number, okay, a complex number. If I draw a shape with one open leg, that's a vector. So one index, one leg, right? Very simple. So if you have two legs, then that's a matrix and so on. In general, we have rank n tensors. So we have an object with n legs coming out of that, right? So every time you see a line that joins two objects, that means matrix multiplication, or in general, tensor contraction. So in that example, I take a matrix A, right? I multiply that by a vector V, and as a result of that calculation, I get a vector W. Question? You mean what is the dimension here? Whatever, chi, okay. It's gonna be, it depends on your tensor network. So actually, it's the maximum you can have on your computer. That's the limit. The larger, the better. Okay. What's that? Yeah, I will talk about that later. This is just a notation. Okay, there's no other meaning right now. Okay, so let me just summarize that. This is a an example of tensor contraction. It's very simple. It's just matrix vector multiplication, and here is a graphical way of saying that, and this is a formula just saying the same, all right? Okay, I know this is last session of the day, right? It's 4 p.m., but I have an exercise for you. So given that notation, right? Where is this? Given that notation, what is that object? A number, good. What else can you say about that? Come on, trace, okay, of what? Of a product of four matrices, that's right, okay. So let me go through that again. So you look at that object, there are no outcoming, there are no open wires, right? So that's a number, then you see that there are four multiplications here, and then in the end, you take a trace, right? So that's a trace of A, B, C, D. Okay, so now we are prepared to go back to the first slide and to understand this. So once again, you take this huge object, and then you wanna replace that with something that you can handle on your computer. So a tensor, so a network of small tensors, and then the rank of each is chi. So that's answering your question, and then we'll use it as a variational ansatz, you can understand that. So the larger chi, the more variational parameters I have, so the better approximation of the wave function I have, or the ground state of that Hamiltonian network, all right? So this is, to answer your question, this is the best I can, this is the largest I can have on my computer, this is the limit. You give me better computer, then I have twice that, okay? All right. Let me give you some examples of tensor networks. Now in one dimension, this is probably the simplest tensor network you can think of. So you take a lattice, here is your lattice, and then with every side of a lattice, you associate a tensor. And then you join a tensor with nearest neighbors, just like that. Okay, so this tensor network just follows the geometry of a lattice, right? This is the simplest thing. All right, but you don't have to be that shy. You can explore another dimension, right? So the wave function is gonna be one dimensional, but your tensor network can grow like crazy, okay? So this is another example. You can build things like tree tensor networks or multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz, which was proposed by Gifre Vidal, who sits over here. Okay. I'm not gonna prove it, but just let me say that. Remember that we start from a Hamiltonian. Somebody gives me a Hamiltonian and asks what is the ground state of that Hamiltonian. So which one, so which tensor network should I use, right? So if the Hamiltonian is gap, then probably this one would be your choice, but if the Hamiltonian is gapless, it would rather use Gifre's idea, okay? You can generalize that to two dimensions, of course. So the natural generalization of MPS to 2D so-called projected entangled first state, PEPS. And you can take that complex structure, make it even more complex to have two-dimensional multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz. Okay, as I told you, today I'm gonna focus on matrix product state, and let me actually show you that that's an efficient representation of a many-body wave function. So let's count the number of parameters that one has to specify to have an MPS wave function. So this is my lattice. I have n sides here. And with every side, I associate a tensor, right? So I have n tensors. So the number of coefficients that I have to store on my computer grows only linearly with the size of the system. So that should be compared to the exponential growth of this guy here. And the number of parameters that you have to specify is one thing, but the other thing is how do I extract an information from that encoded wave function? Okay, this also has to be efficient. So let's see that. So I'll give you an example. So let's calculate some local observable. Say it's just sigma z on the site number 3. It's here and here. In two cases. So that's the general case, okay, and that's the MPS case. So in general case, you would need to perform d to power n plus one basic multiplications on your computer. So that's again exponentially, that's again exponential in the size of the system, so that this is not efficient at all. But look at this, I claim that this is that this calculation can be done in time that grows only linearly in n. So look at this tensor network. That's a number, right? And then the question is, how do I contract that efficiently? So there are many ways of doing that, and most of them are just not efficient, but there is one that does the job. So we start from left, and you contract tensor by tensor. So you take those two tensors, you build one tensor, and then you construct that tensor with another one from left, then yet another one, and so on. One tensor at a time. So we don't want to construct everything at once. That's not efficient. So the whole point is that you can construct that tensor by tensor from one side to another side. And the key point here is that every such contraction does not depend on the size of the system. So the number of basic operations, number of matrix multiplication is linear in N. So it's efficient. Okay. And that's the key. So you can, let me go back here. So we can come up with anything you like. Like, we can build crazy structures, which are efficient in the point of view that you just have to specify a few parameters to have your wave function. But it could be that there's no way you can efficiently contract the tensor network. So we need those two things, and MPS is such an example. All right. Okay, any questions so far? I'm done with the first part of the talk. Okay, now.
Are you getting something for that?
Sure, as always. No. This is an approximation, right? So obviously I can't take the most general wave function, right, and then come up with this simple approximation. No. So this is only for a subset of wave functions. So now imagine that I have this huge set of wave functions, okay? And then I have this control parameter chi. The larger chi, the better approximation I have here, okay? So if I set chi equals zero, this is just a product state. So this is a small corner in this huge space of wave functions. Okay. And now I keep increasing that chi. So my set of wave functions that I can efficiently represent growth with chi, right? So it's larger and larger. And of course, I'm not going to cover everything, that's for sure. But there is huge class of wave functions that I can actually represent in that way. And the ground state of gap Hamiltonian belongs to that class. So for gap state, for gap Hamiltonians, the ground state should be written in that form. It should be possible to do this. This is what I hope. But in the end, it's just a simulation that will answer that question: is it efficient or not? Well, not efficient, but is it a good approximation to the ground state? So this is an experiment that we need to do. But it looks okay, right? So give me. So now I'm ready to go to another. Part of my talk, the second one, and also the last one. So let me give you some example of application of matrix product state, and this is the work done with Gifre Vidal. So our goal here was kind of ambitious. So our starting point is that microscopic 2D lattice Hamiltonian, so you give me your favorite 2D Hamiltonian, and we wanted to create a tool that will answer the following questions. So is this Hamiltonian responsible for topological order, and if yes, what is the emergent onion model in general? I don't want to know anything about the Hamiltonian, just specify that Hamiltonian, that's it. Okay, so what do I mean by characterize an emergent onion model? So you look at the bulk, but you also look at the edge. So in the bulk, I want to specify an onion model. So to give all these details, like give what are the quantum dimensions, fusion rules, twist, central charge, this information all encoded in so-called modular SNU matrices, but also we would like to figure out what is the conformal field theory for DH theory, right? Okay, so we'll achieve that goal in two steps. So in the first one, I take your Hamiltonian, I put it on an infinite cylinder, and then using tensor networks, I can obtain a complete set of ground states. And what is important here, but I, of course, don't have time to prove it, that every ground state that we obtain with that method will have a well-defined onion flux inside the cylinder here. Okay, so once I have those states, then I can say something about DH conformal field theory by looking at the entanglement spectrum. So this is one part. And then the second part is to take those ground states on infinite cylinder, cut this ground state, cut a piece from that ground state, glue it back to form a torus. It sounds like a magic. This is a part of magic of tensor networks, like you can actually cut your ground state like a cake, to form a torus with well-defined flux now inside a torus. And I will argue that that's a good approximation for a ground state on the Hamiltonian on a torus now. And now we have a method So once we have a basis of world, of states of well-defined flux on the torus, we have a method of calculating the modular SNU matrices for the bulk onion model. And once we have that, I can come back here and calculate and extract all these quantities that will define the model that the onion model that we have here. Okay, so this is the model that I will be dealing with. This is a Haldane model of hardcore bosons. This is the Hamiltonian. So hardcore bosons can hop between nearest neighbors, next nearest neighbors, and next nearest neighbors. We built time reversal symmetry here. So this model was studied in that paper, but as I told you, I just want this Hamiltonian, and I should build the entire picture just from that, right? I don't want to know details. I want to figure out by myself. Okay, so the first point of the procedure is to, as I told you, is to take that Hamiltonian, put on infinite cylinder, and obtain a complete set of ground states. So for that particular model, I see that my method gives me only two ground states. So once I have a two ground state, I run my simulation for the third time, but every time I try, I get either state number one or either state number two. So it could be that my method, you know, doesn't see something, but this is a best guess for now, that there are only two ground state. That means that the number of onion types is also two. Later on, I will be able to check this conjecture that we only have two onion types. Okay, but for now, this is just a guess. So now I can take those two states. I can calculate reduced density matrix for the half of the system. This is the cap of the system. And then I can calculate its eigenvalues and associate momenta to them. And this is what I get. So I'm giving you entanglement energies here versus momentum for those two states that I'm getting. This is the state number one, and this is the state number two. And now the goal is to look at those pictures and figure out what is the conformal field theory, DH. So we have two options here to do that. Either you go to Shougan and ask, or you take a yellow book and look for the tables that will describe conformal field theory. So actually, we did both approaches. Okay. So we have some input from Shougan here to look at the degeneracy pattern, but then we started browsing this yellow book and then figured out that, oh, it's a table that we are looking for. Look, all these degeneracies match 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5 in every tower, the same for one state and the same for the other. The entanglement energies, the differences here, this is just a scaling. This is important that this is 4. So I'm getting that 4 exactly here. And also for the other state, 9/4. 9/4 here. So it's perfect match, right? We're lucky. It's this. It's the SU2 level 1 Vesumino-Witten conformal field theory. So we can identify primary fields. That's identity. This is a singlet of SU2. And that's chiral boson doublet of SU2. Okay. So now I know. So previously I just knew that there is some anion propagating inside this infinite cylinder. Now I know what is the type of that anion. So for the state number one, it's identity. This is identity. For the state number two, it's semion. It's half of the fermion. OK, this is the first step. Now let me go to the second step. How much time do I have? OK, thanks. Should be fine. So the second step is to take the ground state on infinite cylinder, cut a piece from that to form a ground state on a finite torus. So as I told you, this is a part of the magic of tensor network that you can actually do that. So if this is my tensor network for infinite cylinder, this is an MPS. So you see that MPS snake here. So to go from infinite cylinder to finite torus, you just need to cut this line here, cut this line here, and then reconnect, and you are done. Okay. So if I have the property that inside an infinite cylinder, I have a well-defined flux, then I also have the same property inside the torus, right? So if the correlation length of the ground state is small enough, then I claim that once this is a good approximation of a ground state on infinite cylinder, that's a good approximation to a ground state on finite torus. Okay. It's not the best one, but it's good. So you could ask, so why don't you re-optimize here all the stencils? Because it may be a good approximation, but you could do better. So the thing is that the MPS with open boundary conditions or infinite MPS is a way cheaper than MPS with a periodic boundary condition. So this algorithm scales, as you remember, as some refinement parameter chi to power 3. Then at the same time, this algorithm to obtain a ground state on a torus will scale as chi to power 5. And now this refinement parameter, the best we can do on our computers is around 8,000. So if one algorithm costs 8,000 to power 3, then this algorithm, then that would be like 16 million times more expensive. So it's undoable to touch that state. Okay. So this is why we study. This is one thing why we study infinite cylinders, and then we use that trick to go back to torus. Okay. All right. So we can do this, and then once we have this basis of ground states with well-defined flux inside the torus, we have a method that you can read in that paper to calculate a U and S matrix by calculating overlaps between a ground state on a torus and another ground state on a rotated torus. Okay. So if you look at this overlap, it doesn't look correct, right? It looks like this torus is different from that. So you can ask, so why do you calculating? So this guy belongs to different Hilbert spaces, but actually this torus is the same as this. So by periodicity, I can take that half of the torus and move it here, right? So I can do this. And this tori are now the same. So this overlap makes sense. So I can calculate that. So you can plug in that equation the general form for modula S and modula U matrix to obtain that matrix. And I switch on my computer, I wait a few weeks, and I got this four numbers. So you see weeks and weeks of simulations, and in the end, I have these four numbers. Great algorithm, right? Okay, but it looks pretty random, right? But it's not. So you can now take element by element, and using those numbers, extract every element of S matrix and every element of U matrix. So once you do this, you obtain that form of S and U matrices. So I wrote it in a funny way. So I just split S and U. I split the result into two pieces. So this is S and U matrix for a chiral simeon that you can find in the tables, and the deviation that I get. So we see that deviation is of the order of 10 to minus 3 on S matrix and similar on the U matrix. So there is no way I could just pick up the wrong theory from the table, right? So the deviation will have to be like twice of that. But it's that exact. It's one up to the third power, up to the third digit. Okay, so having SNU matrices, I can now look at those matrices and extract all the properties that I was talking about. So I look at the first row of DS matrices, it's a quantum dimension, so in that case it's 1, 1. The total quantum dimension is just a square root of a sum of squares, so it's square root of 2. You look at DS matrix, you use Berlin the formula to figure out what are the fusion rules, and of course there are Z2 fusion rules, so you should. You look at the U matrix and you read out the central charge, which here is 1, and also the twist. So twist of identity is 1, but what I want to underline here is the twist of the semion, which is I. So what does it inform you? So we take two semions, you exchange their positions, and you get a phase of I. This is not a boson, not a fermion, it's half of the fermion. You would have to do this twice to get a change, to change a sign, to get a phase of minus 1. So that's exciting. I have that state on my computer, right? And then I can play with it. All right. I think it's going to be it. So let me summarize. So I believe that I convinced you that tensor networks provide an efficient representation of a many-body wave function, in particular ground state of a many-body Hamiltonian. And then in the second part, I show you how can you use matrix product state, but also maybe other tensor networks to come up with a tool that will characterize a topological order that emerges from a given Hamiltonian in 2D. So once again, I start with a Hamiltonian, you give me your favorite one, and then I follow the prescriptions to figure out what is the Anion model and what is the conformal field theory at the edge. Right. And with this, I would like to thank you for attention.
Okay, we have time for some questions.
So I have a couple of questions. So first one, looks like you're a bit limited, right, in terms of states you can describe by the circumference of the cylinder.
That's right. Right,
so you can describe states with the correlation length, which is less than 4 unit cells, right?
It's model dependent, but if you use uh-huh. matrix product state in 2D, then the cost of the simulation grows exponentially in the width.
Exponentially. So let's say if you wanted to double it, it would be...
Okay, that's a bit confusing, right? Because at the beginning I told you, no, there is no exponential cost, right? It's mm-hmm. linear in the system size. But this is for 1D. Okay, if you have a 1D system, then okay, it's linear. Here I have infinite, but of course the cost isn't infinite because I use translational invariance. So here mm-hmm. I just have a few tensors, a unit cell that is repeated infinity many times. So this cost is reduced from n to 1. Okay. But if you want to use MPS in 2D, like here, you'd have to cheat a bit, right? So you would have to order sides and then snake around. Mm-hmm. So okay, that looks like a cheating, but it works, okay? So in 2D, it's true that the cost is exponential in the width of the cylinder. So you would have to make sure that your correlation length is much smaller than the maximum width of the cylinder that you can handle. And this is the case here. So this is mm-hmm. one of the self-consistency checks that we can run. So we can calculate an upper bound for any correlation length in the system mm-hmm. and first check whether it's smaller than the maximum width of the cylinder. So of course we've done that, but mm-hmm. I didn't show that. So I'm running many models, and actually this is one that I really trust the results, because mm-hmm. the others you see, correlation length is a bit too large. I should forget about that. Mm-hmm. But this is fine.
I see. So, and the second question is, in fractional quantum Hall effect, there are cases when you have several competing phases. Let's say if you are at half filling, you could consider competition between Pfaffian state, stripe state, right, and the composite Fermi liquid. So, did you think about trying to map out some phase diagram?
The phase diagram.
Like that.
From my perspective, phase diagrams are quite complicated because I would have to, start my simulation every point in the phase diagram. And to get, of course, if you don't want that precision that I got here, like 3 digits on S matrix, then you don't need all these weeks for a simulation. But 1 point, it's a bit expensive in 2D. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so you can, there's always a risk that during your optimization, you will get stuck somewhere. And that's not a true ground state. And that's a different. So, the best we can do is we can run a simulation for different refinement parameter here. So this is a chi, so the number of states that you keep. And then once you see convergence in chi, so suppose that I just have a simulation for chi for 1,000 and then for 2,000. So I just double that chi. And then I see that there is no change in all expectation values that I can measure, then I will trust that result. But of course, it's just numerics. I'm not doing anything. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
Additional questions?
Just a very, very basic question. So this theory is able to see broken symmetry phases, spontaneously broken symmetries?
Yeah, sure.
But this is not a finite size system that you're modeling?
What's that?
You're not modeling finite size systems, then you're modeling infinite systems.
But okay, I'm not limited to infinite systems, so I can start with finite system, then larger and larger, and then infinite, and then I can map out all the possibilities. So we can do that. Okay.
Additional questions?
What is the reason I didn't use PEBS? Okay, thanks. So DMRG is well known. It behaves really, really good. You can trust all these results, whereas PEBS is more difficult to handle. It's more shaking, and it's way more difficult to handle. So the first step was to use MPS to have uh, to to trust all these results to understand the algorithm, and then the second step would be to use PEPs. So this is something that I'm working on, to use PEPs, because then I would, the cost does not grow exponentially in the way for the cylinder. It's just fixed, so it doesn't matter. But as I told you with PEPs, it's a bit tricky because it could be that you look at the results and you think, okay, is it the property of the system or is it the property of the method? Because I don't really understand what this thing is. Okay, so that's the first step, and then we go to PEPs for the real thing. Thanks.
Okay, so I think we'll stop there and thank the speaker one more time.